Working Cows Podcast, Episode 71.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy everybody, it's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. I am joined today by Logan Pribino of the Wine Glass Ranch. We're going to talk to him about some of the paradigm-challenging practices they're putting into play on their operation and how they are using those for the benefit of their land and their people and their cattle and all those different things. So it's really good to get Logan on here. Actually, I think his dad, Jeff, was a suggested guest by one of the perennial guests of the Working Cows Podcast and didn't really put two and two together that I was getting the other half of that equation when I reached out to Logan based on a tweet that he had sent. So, Logan, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Happy to be here, Clay.
So I originally reached out to you in response to a tweet that you sent out in September of this year. That is wheat going in right after a 300 beef pounds per acre harvest, going to have to change the name, the business name to That Won't Work Here, LLC. And you are part of the Wine Glass Ranch. Is that correct?
That's correct. We haven't officially changed the name to That Won't Work Here, LLC, but I've got my lawyer on it.
That's right. So can you just give me a little bit of a preview of the thinking behind that tweet and why you're doing things that the neighbors maybe think are a little crazy?
Sure. Well, we're based out of southwest Nebraska, and it's certainly farm country down here. Probably two-thirds of the acres in this county is farm ground, and we are farmers as well. And in this part of the world, to ensure wheat and certainly accepted practices that you fallow your ground for a full year before you drill wheat, and in this part of the world, that does mean with tillage equipment. And we've been working for several years to get away completely from that on our dryland crop rotation. And so this is our third year of running a forage crop where we graze it off in August and then drill wheat in September right behind it. And the first 2 years were sort of smaller test plots. And this is the first year where we really went full in. So all of our wheat that we drilled this year was behind a grazing crop and the best grazing crop that we've grown in the 3 years. We were able to harvest 200 to 300 beef pounds per acre on average. That field that I showed a picture of was the 300 pounds per acre harvest, which was as good as we've ever done.
What are you guys doing there as far as the forage crops, and how are you managing some of those resources?
Sure. So our forage crop, we grow it like a standing silage crop. It's a mix of whatever seed we can get fairly cheap. Our total cost target for that for seed would be $10 to $12. I think this year we crept up a little bit over that $12 mark due to some redrilling. But when you're looking at pricing something in that range, you have to be fairly flexible of what kind of seed you use. This year it was heavy with forage sorghum. We threw in some dicamba-resistant soybeans, sunflower, and just basically whatever we could get our hands on. If you drove by it, though, it looked like someone put a lot of different sorghums in a field, and they really had no idea what they were doing. But looks can be deceiving.
The animals didn't seem to mind. Is that what you're saying?
No, it is always a joy. We turn out onto those forage fields right after the 4th of July, and it is absolutely one of my favorite times of the year. You get, 1,000 steers standing in a sorghum field, and for the first hour, they just look at you like, we're not supposed to be here, and that guy's going to start yelling at us at any minute. And you have to kind of hang out there until they, realize that, no, this is your guy's feed.
All for me? Really?
It is fun. It is one of the more enjoyable things that I get to do every year.
That's cool. Is that kind of when you guys are seeing a decline in the grass that you have access to, is in July around the 4th?
Yeah, that's correct. And so like in southwest Nebraska, we're a little bit different than the Sandhills. Our grass kind of peters out a little bit earlier than the rest of the state. So we find that our protein declines heavily in the heat of July. And so by the 4th of July, our crude protein levels are really below performance level. And so we'll run our stalkers only on the range May and June and, you know, into July, just to kind of get through the holidays.
So you guys, you mentioned that you're keeping an eye on costs, you're keeping an eye on protein levels in your forages and trying to make sure that you're always on a good plane of nutrition for your animals. You know, that's that indicates a high level of management. What is the motivation behind that, or what was the impetus of starting those kind of higher level management practices on your operation?
Well, the inclusion of stalkers, we're a traditional cow-calf ranch, since coming on board 6 years ago, we've expanded our stalker enterprise greatly to the point where today we're about 50-50 cow-calf and stalker on an animal unit basis. And stalkers are really culturally are not common anywhere in the state of Nebraska. And they can be run in this state. And, you know, we're not just me, but there are a handful of people in the state. They're showing you how you can do it. And it does involve some creativity. It's not like it is in the Flint Hills where you can just sort of kick the steers out on the grass and collect them, a few months later and collect your check. So we've designed exactly like you said, it's a forage chain where every step is an improvement in the nutrition. So right now we're running our stalkers on corn stalks, supplemented with a 28% cube, and pretty extensively. We'll throw out 3 to 4 pounds per head per day, and we're lucky to get a 1 to 1.2 average daily gain out of that. After corn stalks, we go on to wheat pasture, which we rent from farmers. We'll interseed into their irrigated corn fields, and they'll graze from the end of March until grass green up on our native range, which is typically May 5th. And then they're on the native range, rotationally grazing through our pastures, our developed pastures, for May and June. And then the final stage is that standing silage crop where they should do, depending on how green they are from the previous forage segments, they can do as high as a 3.0 average daily gain.
You mentioned that stalkers are not culturally common there. What are some of the responses you get, you know, kind of along this theme of that won't work here? What are some of the responses you get, or how have you guys been able to beat expectations, I guess, with some of the things that you're doing?
Sure. I think just stalkers not working on sand hills. There are people before me that have proven that wrong, but it still is prevalent throughout the state. And it's just, it has to be very well managed. As I said before, for us, stalkers is really about pasture utilization and having as many animals as physically possible on the range in May and June when our pasture quality, is peaking. And so it really goes back to, it can work if you're willing to work at it and you're really willing to analyze the data and make changes to allow them to work.
So basically the stalkers for you are matching the available forage to the stocking rate. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, with our rotational grazing and rest system, you can only get so far running only pairs, and it really doesn't fit very well for drought management and for optimum grass management, to just run a single class of animals. And, you know, there are other people that are running a totally different species of animals, which I think is probably even better if you're looking to fully utilize your range. But for us at Wineglass, I think the answer is probably yearlings for now to get the that maximum utilization at its peak.
And it's also a bit of a safety valve. I think that's a phrase that was used a lot early on in the Working Cows podcast, is a bit of a safety valve for you guys as far as drought is concerned. Is that accurate?
That's correct. And we'll run, it is our it's the ultimate safety valve for half of it to be disposable stalkers. And even further, we'll run 1,000 of our stalkers run as custom with our neighbors, so that even if we're looking a little dry to begin with, they have a feed yard right next door to us, and we can, you know, in a moment's notice, pretty much get that 1,000 off of the operation.
And what role does that play in the overall cash flow management of the operation? How are you guys making these stalkers work for you? How do you time the selling of them, some of the marketing situation and all those things?
Sure. Well, we've been paying our dues in the acquisition side of things. And, you know, every year we've kind of tweaked things and changed things. We really learned this year that we have to be purchasing a baller early on and straightening them out to really get a decent profit margin in them with the gains that we get with our forage chain. And what we do, so our primary product at Wineglass Ranch is a 850-pound natural yearling shipped in August. So that'd be right at the tail end of August. We really want to beat that September yearling rush. So we try to push them and get them out of here by August. And by September, our forage, our standing silage forage crop starts to decline in value. And that 850-pound natural yearling shipped in August will kill in February for the purchaser of the feed yard. And that is typically the peak of live cattle for the year.
You mentioned rotationally grazing. You mentioned grazing through the forage crops and some of those things. How much of that goes into the ethos of that won't work here, or challenging those previously held notions in the neighborhood?
Sure. I do have to just brag on our neighborhood a little bit. We do have great neighbors. My father was an early adapter to the rotational grazing style under Alan Savory in the mid to late 90s, and our neighbors took notice pretty quick. And I would say that of our larger neighbors, Maddox Cattle Company would be one to the southeast, and K Cattle Kennings to the northeast practice some version of rotational grazing. So that won't work here of this area probably 15 years ago. And slowly but surely, pretty much most of the large professionally run outfits in this part of the country are utilizing it to some extent.
And what about the terrain that you're in? What kind of a role does that play in the opportunities that you guys have?
Yeah, well, with the terrain, it's our range is choppy sands, and it's really limited in this county. As I mentioned before, it's one-third irrigated farm ground, one-third dryland farm ground, and one-third range. Expansion opportunities in this county in particular is really going to involve getting cattle out onto farm ground and onto some other people's ground, just because of the layout of the county. So the stalker enterprise has allowed us to grow onto other people's ground, where we rent and interseed or just grow a straight up irrigated forage crop. So expansion opportunity in this part of the woods does involve, you know, farm ground, and for Wineglass it involves putting animals on farm ground.
And what are the logistics of those relationships? How are you guys finding the ground that is open to those practices, and how are you getting permission to go into somebody's existing cornfield and interseed other crops and some of those things?
We have a great relationship with the farmers all over Chase County, and we are farmers ourselves too, dryland farmers. We rent about 90 quarters of irrigated corn stalks every winter to run cows on. So we have a Rolodex full of farmers that have been working with us for decades in the past. And so for us to get in some interseeded crops or get some irrigated ground rented from them on a, you know, on a short sublease basis has really proven to be pretty easy. If you're willing to pay sort of the fair market rent, which we do, we treat people fairly.
So how do you go about deciding what is going to be an economically viable option when it comes to renting ground and some of those things?
Sure. We really utilize gross margin analysis as our primary tool. It goes with the ranching for profit that my dad, he went full in on it in, in the 90s, and I was raised around gross margin analysis. So we will typically use gross margin analysis to explore different enterprises, different cropping mixes, and expansion opportunities.
And you have mentioned, you know, the cropping mix that you're shooting for, was it, I think, $10 to $12 an acre. So you're not just going to the agronomist and saying, give me whatever you want. You're making some decisions based on the economics on the front end that affords you opportunities on the back end. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and we do. We've got some, we're blessed with great neighbors. Steve Tucker, who has spoken at No-Till on the Plain, supplies most of our seed and kind of acts as the middleman for us and the cover croppers in our area. So it really goes back to having good neighbors, honestly, to keep that cost where it is.
Logan, just a quick break as I thank my Patreon supporters. I mentioned last week that I was starting some theme posts in the Facebook group. And so here's just a quick example of one of those theme posts that I made this week, asking some questions about budgeting in the operation and how you're using technology to bring that to bear. Today, I wanted to talk to you on Tech Tuesday about what are we doing with our technology tools to develop a good budget. And the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is because I was watching a video with Burke Tigert yesterday, and he was talking about how a good spreadsheet you can use to determine the relationship between different classes of animals on your operation and what they will be worth and what they have been worth in the past, and that that is the most helpful tool in budgeting is how you develop those budget tools based on the relationship of one class of animals to another class of animals. So I want to talk to you about what tools you are using in your, what technology tools specifically you are using in your operation to develop a budget that is actually helpful and providing helpful information to you. So if you want to jump in on the comments section and tell me about the budget tools that you're using on your operation and how they are informing the decisions that you are making. So if you want to get involved in these conversations, go ahead and support the Working Cows podcast at patreon.com/workingcows, or you can check out workingcows.net/support if you want to look at other ways that you could support the podcast. And what have you guys kind of experienced as the return on investment, I guess I'll say it that way, as far as the holistic management or the rotational grazing? You know, was that a constant improvement? Was there a point at which it plateaued? What did that look like for you guys?
Sure. Well, I've got some numbers on that. So we have been rotationally grazing since the 90s. We've pretty quickly got our animal units per acre is what I like to use. I know everyone has a different favorite unit, but we were able to increase our stocking rate by about 30%. The NRCS says you should be getting about a half to a 0.6 animal unit month per acre. We were very easily able to get up to a 7 to a 7.5 with rotational grazing with pairs. By doing two things, we've gotten that up to where we're running double that. So this last couple of years, we've been at a 1.34 animal units an acre. The first one of those is you know, putting stalkers on the range only at the peak in May and June. And the second one was we moved to a 100-day rest on the advice of Burke Tykert. And we also had the great fortune of watching Maddox Cattle Company, our neighbors. They were about 3 years ahead of us on that. And they made that switch. And you could see it from across the line that that change was a positive change. So the rotational grazing really allowed us to effectively double our AUM harvest each year.
So we're going to follow up on both of those issues. First, I want to hear more about the economic importance of matching the forage availability to the stocking rate. How much of a role does that play in your profitability?
You mean in terms of, can you rephrase the question for me?
Yeah, sure. Stockers, the stockers themselves, what kind of a role are they playing in you guys being able to maximize the use of your standing forage? It's similar to the safety valve question, but more from a profitability perspective, what kind of a role do they play in harvesting those available AUMs at the right time?
Sure. Well, the accepted farmland rotation, which most dryland farmers would have in southwest Nebraska, is a fallow wheat, no-till corn into the wheat stubble. And stalkers, so you start looking at, you know, your fallow period, obviously, is what you hone in on when you're trying to adjust your ROA or your return on investment to. And if you're going to grow a forage crop or a cover crop, it is best utilized with the nutrients that it's in. It's best utilized in a growing animal as opposed to, you know, a cow or a pear for that matter. So to grow for us to make these kind of cover crop / forage crop work, we did needed to have a large number of stalkers kind of in queue to make that transition pay.
And then the other one was the 100-day rest, the transition to that, and the benefits of it. Could you talk a little bit more about the difference that that's made on your operation?
Sure. So we switched to 100-day rest in 2017. In 2017, most of Nebraska was really challenged in the middle of the summer with very little rainfall. We went 60 days and got less than a quarter inch of rain. It was the first year we moved to the 100-day rest before we'd been to the 60-day rest for, more than a decade. Our neighbors had to lock up their pears and feed them a full ration in their feed yard. And you went out on our range with that 100-day rest and there was just grass galore. So that 100-day rest, we got there in the nick of time. I do believe that had we stuck with the tried and true for us anyway, the 60-day rotation in 2017, we would have had to destock the ranch. Instead of destocking the ranch, that 100-day rest allowed us to really flourish and had no animal performance issues whatsoever and remain fully stocked despite that 60-day window.
And so you're talking about the rest period during what time of the year and how are you managing that kind of ballet on paper, I guess, as it were, of the rest and what's getting grazed when?
Sure. The 100-day rest, it regionally, is just what we kind of talk about. It's Rex Ranch, and everyone in Nebraska always talks about how many days you're resting. It is only during the growing season. So virtually all of Nebraska, cattle are really only on the range for the summer, and our cattle are the same. Everything is on corn stalks right now and is for all the winter. So 100-day rest means we graze each of our paddocks twice at the most, three times exceptionally if it's in a, prime location, and a few only once. So that is really is what a 100-day rest looks like in Nebraska.
Okay, so what you mentioned earlier, your improved pastures, can you define an improved pasture for me, and then we'll circle back to this 100-day rest?
Sure. I would you know, an improved pasture to me looks like cover. You know, it's really what makes a difference. The more cover you have, the more cover you leave in the fall, the more grass you're going to grow next year. We had Jim Garish came out for a visit last year. And one of the biggest takeaways I had, and one thing that he really beat into us, was never be afraid to waste grass. And so despite, you know, harvesting double what the county average is, you know, if you go out into our pastures today, you know, they don't look great. You're not going to, you know, start handing out awards and, you know, hit me on the back, but they do look good and there is sufficient cover in there so that we are going to be able to grow some grass next year.
And then what about the paddock sizes on these pastures that you're grazing during the growing season? What is the average size of a paddock, and how are you guys managing those?
Sure. Well, we were one of the first larger developed ranches that my dad did in the 1990s, you know, under Alan Savory's approval. And we have the classic wagon wheel, which originally they thought that you wouldn't have to do a lot of water development, that you could sort of water out of the middle of these wagon wheels. And we learned very quickly, especially on sands, that that's just not an option. So our ranch is set up like a wagon wheel that someone went in and said, oh, this isn't really going to work. Let's add some fences and some water sources to kind of give you the 10,000 foot view. So every paddock does have two 11 foot stock tanks fed by underground pipeline and 3-horsepower wells. So really good recharge rate, because we do like to run larger groups. The average paddock size is about 300 to 350 acres.
And what kind of time are they spending in there?
It'll be always less than a week, generally 4 to 6 days.
Are the same paddocks rested? You said that some are only grazed once. Are those same paddocks grazed once every year, or is it different paddocks get grazed more intensely one year and rested more the next?
Sure. We do vary it up as much as we can. We do have some that just happen to be next to some facilities that we do try to defer grass always. But what we'll generally do, we are that classic wagon wheel. So one year we go clockwise, and next year we go counterclockwise. So it's a really foolproof way of making sure that you get some different utilization year after year.
You said that you are always looking for other opportunities, or that you're trying to figure out a way to take it to the next level, so to speak, as far as the operation as a whole is concerned, and kind of bringing it back to that won't work here. What are some things that you guys are considering, and how are you going to go about testing them before implementing them full scale and some of those things?
Well, right now we are on year 3 of a large-scale stocker program, and we are really still tinkering with it. There's so many different variables in it, from the acquisition to the marketing and this nutritional plane, that we've really committed ourselves to running stockers for the better part of a decade and figuring out the way to make it work and to get these critters onto our farmland to kind of inject a little bit of life into them. So we do have some different things that we're going to be tinkering with, but it really all falls under this umbrella of stockers in Nebraska gaining well and spending a lot of their life on our farmland or someone else's.
Are you bringing any of those stockers in from your own herd, or are most of them outside?
It's about 50-50. So we produce not quite half of the stockers that we run, and we acquire the other half through various means. We did switch to GAP 4 this year. We've always, or not always, but the last several years we have run a natural herd, and so we are growing sort of in that natural to in the GAP 4 premium system. So that requires that you do acquire your stockers on the video or private treaty, which we did for the first time this year and really got along well doing that, as opposed to buying out of the sale barn.
And is that another long-term commitment to see, or is that something that you can kind of analyze right away and see, is that working or not?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, because We were more conventional when you looked at our stalker program. Almost all of our stalkers that we, all of them that we acquired were just conventional implanted steers. And then, you know, we had 2 years of data and we looked at it and our natural steers were always a clear winner and our conventional steers were always fairly tight. So we made the decision this year to grow into, you know, what's working. And for us, that's been a lightweight natural steer. And so, more than half of our stalkers this year will be, you know, right now, today, they're only a 4-weight, and we're going to grow them to that 8-weight by August.
What else are you guys doing to control input costs? We've talked about the cost per acre of your cover crops and some of those things. What else are you guys doing to control input costs, not just in the stalkers, but in the cow herd generally?
That's an interesting question. So we had Burke Tucker come out for a couple of days consulting last year. And my dad was an early adopter of, the Saber system, as I've mentioned repeatedly. Probably getting tired of hearing that. But he had a system where he was June calving, and he was extremely low input. And with Burke's guidance, and he doesn't recommend this very often, we're actually increasing our inputs. So we're doing some target supplementation. We've moved our calving date, and really he thought, and you know, we all agree, the board of Wineglass did agree that we were a little bit too far on the low input. So surprisingly, we're kind of going back to adding a little bit of supplementation to our cows at strategic times, maybe pampering them just a little bit more to enhance the cow herd performance.
And what is that performance metric? What are you talking about? Is it fertility, breed up? What are you measuring?
Two numbers in particular, and that's breed up, which for any Mangune calver is a big issue, in particular in southwest Nebraska, where your range, you know, in August is drastically declined. And then also our weaned calf crop percentage, and Tiger, you know, famously uses a different model for that. So we're just how many weaned calves we're bringing to weaning each year.
We're recording this on December 28th of 2018. It will release sometime shortly after the first of the year. And my artist assured me that he would be working on the first of the Working Cows, merchandise t-shirts for, this podcast, and that is that fertility drives the bus. It's a quote I took from Bob Howard's episode, and we're gonna start putting out some of these things, some of these merchandise items, and the first one is gonna be this fertility drives the bus t-shirt. I'm pretty excited about it. So
I like that idea.
Fertility drives the bus of profitability. So hopefully it turns out how it is in my mind, but I'm excited. So that I was excited to hear you mention that as well. Anything else? How about let's wrap up with this. You mentioned a board of directors. We've talked a lot about some major management decisions over the last 3 years with stalkers, talked a lot about other management decisions with the cover crops and the cost of those and some of the other things, going to more supplementation, going gap four, all natural, those kinds of things. How do you guys go about making those decisions? How do you guys go about making sure that you are seeing all the variables? More heads together is better than fewer. Kind of what are you guys doing in those regards?
Sure. Well, there are two things at work here. One's the board of directors, and the other one is the management team at Wineglass. We are a sizable operation. We do have a management team. It's not the Logan Pribino Ranch. There's a cow-calf manager, a stalker manager, and a farm manager. We would not be able to do any of this without them. So we are a team of skilled employees, not a chief and a bunch of Indians and the chief ordering them around. So part of it is the personnel here, which creates a culture that works. And the culture it's filtered down from the top. Wineglass always has been a highly adaptable operation before my time or before my dad's time. So we do have a culture of willingness to change, running the data, trusting the data, and moving into the direction where your data is telling you to go. So we are early adapters to a lot of different things. We like to be on the edge. It's who Wineglass is, and it's not who we are. It's before I was even born, it was that way. So culture is a very big part of that. And the board of directors of Wineglass, we do use the executive link to sort of facilitate some of this board of director content, but ultimately there is a separate board of directors for Wineglass. And it's just run the data, you know, which a lot of ranches don't do. We spend a lot of time accounting for things, running analysis. So it's run the data, number one, trust the data and go in the direction the data is telling you to be. And that's kind of how we make things work at Wineglass.
Very good. Very, very good. So I appreciate your time today, Logan. Thanks for entertaining my my hunting you down based on a tweet that caught my eye. So I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, Clay.
Really good stuff there with Logan Pribno. Really looking forward to upcoming episodes. I've got a pretty good map going on. I got an episode with Charlie Arnott of New South Wales, Australia. If you've been on Facebook and seen any of his stuff, he's a very interesting guy, and they're doing some really interesting and innovative and out-of-the-box stuff in all of Australia, but he's really closely connected to a lot of people who are doing a lot of those really interesting things. So really looking forward to talking to Charlie next week on the podcast. Going forward, I've given you some hints. If you were paying attention, maybe you picked up on them about who my guest for episode 75 is. Also got some good episodes coming up on economics. I got some good episodes coming up on multi-species grazing and sheep in general. So look forward to all that in the next few weeks on the Working Cows podcast. Thanks for your support. And thank you guys so much for the generous support I've received, whether it be through people sending me stuff off my Amazon wish list or people supporting the deal on Patreon. There was a post this week that went out when I sent out the first round of swag to my Patreon supporters who are supporting me at $20 a month or more, and sent them out some pretty cool t-shirts. So if you want to check that out, go over to workingcows.net/contact and look up the social media pages, and you'll see the stuff that I sent out to them that I posted on social media as it was going out in the mail. So thank you again for all your support, your feedback, just reaching out to me. That means a bunch, just letting me know how it's been challenging you. And I really look forward to the future growth of the Working Cows podcast community and just doing some really amazing things over the next few episodes as we are starting to close in on sometime this summer. Probably we'll hit 100 episodes, Lord willing. So really looking forward to that, and looking forward to continuing to spread the wings of the Working Cows podcast and get even farther outside of my own comfort zone in related to the relationship to these things. And this has been a rant that's gone on far too long, but I'm really excited about the future of the Working Cows podcast. So tune in next week for Charlie Arnott on the Working Cows podcast, and we will see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.